Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast, episode number 155. And this is one of your co-hosts, Stephen Zimmer, talking to you live from central Kentucky in the Bluegrass, and joined tonight by the dynamic duo of Daniel Dark and Michael West, who are on the air with me. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
There they are. Who's there? That's a good question, because today the internet has been wonky, to say the least. And Daniel and I were comparing notes, and it wasn't just affecting Facebook. It was all across the board. And so we hope there are no glitches. But yeah, just be aware, it's been a very wonky day online, and we even had our show page disappear for a while on Blog Talk Radio, and that gave us a little bit of a palpitation, but it did get corrected. So we will do our best. We will do our best, but hopefully it'll go smooth and we'll get through and have a great interview with our guest tonight.
Word today kept acting up on me. It kept like shutting down. It's like, you know, you have lost communication with Word. And I'm like, well, how can I lose communication with Word?
Do you subscribe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It should still.
No.
Most of the software should still work offline, though. That's kind of strange. Yeah.
Yeah,
once you have it installed.
Yeah.
Because I know my Creative Cloud suite, when I'd get disconnected from the internet, I mean, the Photoshop and all that still works. I mean, so I haven't specifically tried to see if Word does or not, but that would be a disaster.
Well, the only thing I can think of is that I was doing some research at the time, and I didn't have the internet up when it was going wonky, so maybe it just kind of like did something with the computer. I don't know, but everything's working fine, but today there's been all kinds of weird stuff going on.
Yeah, your computer downloaded every known virus out there.
Well,
I hope
it did download some kind of ad, something or other that they had to clean off of there, but that's why every time I finish a chapter, Daniel,
mm-hmm.
I know you'll appreciate this. Every time I finish a chapter, I email it to myself, and that way I've got a backup, just in case.
Oh, really? It works better that way.
Yeah.
Hey, you never can be too careful.
Losing everything that you've got written for months and just
yeah.
Oh man. Well, I'm glad you do have a good system for that, Michael. Yeah, because we're looking forward to your next magnum opus that'll be coming out in 2019.
Oh, no one's more excited to have it out there than me. Believe me.
Well, I hope not. You're the man behind it.
it's funny because, you know, that's why I've been living with this for so long, but it finally is like really, really got a mind of its own. Really, it's really moving forward. So I'm happy about that, because the plan is this weekend I will be appearing at Horror Hound in Cincinnati,
right?
Which is at the Sharonville Convention Center. Going to be there with Christopher Lloyd and Elvira and all kinds of stars of TV.
You realize he's just doing name dropping now, don't you? Yeah.
Well, hey, on their podcast, they're saying we're going to be hanging out with Michael West. So, you know, so hey, it's, you know, it just goes around.
But but I will have all the other Legacy of the Gods books there, and all the Harmony novels, and my short story collections, all the be signed. I hope. We have weather issues throughout the country, so hopefully the books reach me before the show. But I do have some books, so it's not going to be a total fiasco if the shipment doesn't show up. But I'm sure it will. I have backup plans engaged. But anyway,
I think it's just
the plan is
they collude just for you, Michael. I think that's what happens.
I think there's a conspiracy. There's an anti-supernatural conspiracy out there,
right?
that wants to block the truth from getting out. Anyway, this September here in Indianapolis, there is another Horror Hound, and that will be for the first time at the Indianapolis Convention Center. It's going to be double the size of the Horror Hound from last year, which was double the size of the traditional Horror Hound. So it's just getting bigger and better. And the goal that I keep working toward day in and day out is to have the final Legacy of the Gods novel, Cronus' Return, done and released and ready for all the faithful readers out there by Horror Hound. So in Indianapolis,
yes,
in September. So that's the goal. That's the goal.
And when is
all
that?
Right,
one?
We're rooting for.
Huh? That's the weekend after Labor Day. In Indianapolis.
The first week or so of September there.
Yeah,
good deal.
It's the first. I don't know if it's the first full weekend of September or the second. It's always the weekend after Labor Day, so
right.
Whether I don't have a calendar right in front of me, but whether Labor Day is on the first Monday, it's always on the first Monday.
Labor Day weekend is that's the big Dragon Con weekend down in Atlanta, so that's what I always think of it that way. So this will be following the following weekend after that, then.
Yeah, it'll be the following weekend. So all you faithful readers out there who have been messaging me nonstop for forever. I love you all. It will.
When's our damn book
night,
getting here?
Yeah. Well, good.
I'm working
well,
day
I'm
and
glad
night to have this thing ready.
Yeah, rabid pack clamoring for the new release. That is good, though. That is a good problem to have.
So yeah, no. I love my faithful readers. I have great readers, great fans and nothing, that's why I love going to conventions. I mean, the bad part about going to a convention is the fact that it does take you away from the writing part of it for a bulk of the day, but the trade-off, which I wouldn't trade for the world, is actually getting to talk to the readers and hear what they love about the stuff I do, and it's just there's nothing more rewarding than when you're a writer, as both of you can attest, you're sitting in your office or sitting at the coffee shop or the park or wherever you're doing your writing, but it's basically just you, it's you and your characters in your head.
Yep.
and that's it's all internal, and it's like putting on a play in an empty auditorium. It's like you don't know how
right
anyone's going to respond or what's working and what's not, but then when you go to these conventions or you go to a book signing at a bookstore or a library or whatnot, and you actually talk to your readers, you get a real sense of how you're engaging them and what's working and what people love. So that's the best
part
about these shows.
Well, see, I've got great reader and great fan too, singular.
Oh, well, come
on
now.
I think that nice, really nice award that you've won, Daniel, speaks to the contrary.
I was about to say, the really nice trophy you just got. So.
That's, that's a beautiful, beautiful little award. And it's not little either, but it's a beautiful award you have there.
Oh, man.
Hey,
oh, man.
For something that I never thought anybody would want to read, hey, I'm not going to object to it at all. Just, if they think it's good, it's good. I don't care.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, man.
Well, that, and yeah, and that's you know, I've gotten messages already this week from people saying, you know, asking me, you know, are you going to be there, right? And I'm like, yeah. And it's like, okay, because I need to pick up some more books. So, you know, that's always, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm, you know, doing a Horror Hound now for 10 years. I pretty much know I'm not going to just go there and twiddle my thumbs all weekend. But it is
right.
Nice that, you know, after
all
these
years.
You're
going to go out the line and everything and sell them outside before they ever get into you. That's,
you know, I have always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to do the Tony Acri patented selling style to the line, but I've never gotten up the courage to do that. So Tony could, you know, sell ice to Eskimos. I think he's good. But,
he's incredible.
This can be your year right here.
Right. Exactly. Oh,
yeah,
man.
Well, that's
too good.
That's the goal. My goal is, you know, is in September, now that, you know, when we have the new book out and the whole series is out there, I might have some package deals or whatnot going for the, you know, people who want to get the entire series in one fell swoop. So, you know, stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really looking forward to, you know, number one, having the book done, but number two, just seeing what, you know, when we're at the hotel there on 21st Street in Indianapolis there for 10 years. And so, you know, it got to be kind of like a home away from home, and you had a familiarity to it. Same thing with the convention center in Sharonville. You know, this is now the, oh gosh, what is it? Seventh year, maybe, that we've been there. So, you know, there's a familiarity to it. It's like it's almost like family reunion when you go there, and there's a comfortability
yep.
that you have when you know where everything is, you know what's what, you know, things do change from year to year, but you pretty much know going in what you're walking into. And then last year, and then we had the new hotel at the big JW Marriott downtown, and so it was a whole new experience. It was a great experience, but it was kind of those, one of those, you know, wow, look what we've come to, kind of a thing, you know. And then now to be in the Indiana Convention Center, you know, just the largest convention space in the state, and taking up basically one whole floor of that is what they're talking. It's going to be something to behold.
Very cool.
Hello?
Very cool.
Okay.
Go get them. Yeah. Well,
did we just tonight,
Mike? Actually.
No, I'm here.
Okay. All sound just dropped off on my end for a second there. I'm sorry.
we're hearing everything pretty good on this end. So,
okay.
But I am going to turn the spotlight to those who support the show and are helping making it possible. So we'll take a brief break here and do listen to these next two little spots. Those who support the Star Chamber show. So. Here we go. Fantasy author Sandy Lender has stories for everyone, especially for readers who like dragons. Realms of Fantasy magazine positively reviewed her dragon-packed novel, Choices Meant for Kings, upon its release. Then, TimelessTeens.com went nuts for the critters in her Dragons in Space series. She's got 10 books available on Amazon.com so far, and she's not stopping. Check out the author page for Sandy Lender on Amazon.com to pick up a new favorite story. And that's Sandy Lender, SandyLender, Sandy Lender. Check her out on Amazon.com on her author page. And we thank her very much, very much for her support of the Star Chamber show.
Yes, very good.
The League of Elder dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
And big thank you to Ren Garcia and the League of Elder series for their support to the Star Chamber show. So there we go. There we go. A couple of excellent folks, and we appreciate them very, very much. And that leads us up, because it looks like on deck we have our guest tonight is ready. So we're going to bring our guest aboard in just a second, but we got to give an introduction first. And tonight's guest is a fantasy author who also happens to be a freelance writer and has worked in social media marketing. And her fantasy novel Moonshadow's Guardian was released in just recently in November of 2018. And then she also has some great stuff going on in the Twitter realm. She hosts the hashtag Weeknight Writers Twitter chat, and that's hashtag Weeknight Writers Twitter chat, and also is a co-host of hashtag Review Pit, which is a real cool concept where authors pitch their books for potential reviewers. And I, of course, am bringing aboard right now our guest tonight, the wonderful Diana Gunn. You are on the Star Chamber. Yeah,
how
good to have
tonight,
you with
Diane?
Us.
I'm excited to be here. My cat is also very excited to be sitting with me here. He seems very interested in what we're talking about.
Very cool. And Holly said to tell you hi. This is not her week to co-host, but yeah, she was the one that of us that at first interacted with you, and she just absolutely is really looking forward to this show, and definitely wanted to send along her hello to you as well.
Awesome. I'm really glad to hear that.
Does your cat wear a hat? Just.
All right,
go
so
ahead, Daniel.
Where do you want to start?
Oh, I think I overrode Daniel there. I think he did ask you something.
Uh-oh.
I said, does your cat wear a hat?
No, not usually. I don't think he would take it very well. We actually tried to put a bow tie on him once, and it was okay for a little bit, but honestly, we woke up one morning and it was gone, and I still don't know where it is. So I think we've given up on clothing him.
Yeah, I have a Russian blue cat named Dubious, and he he'll tolerate a bow tie for a little while, but he's not too big on it. And, but currently, Holly's daughter is sewing him a Viking battle hat. She's making a special Viking battle hat. So we hope that works, because I think it'll be a grand picture for his Facebook page if we can get him to wear it. So. We will see.
Do you have separate Facebook pages for your cat?
I do.
Right,
I have
one
and
people.
An Instagram page for him. So, yes.
I'm not even one of those people. I mean, I love my cats. I actually have two. There's just one who's always nosy when I'm doing stuff like this. But I can't be bothered to give them separate pages. That's way too much work. And then I wouldn't have anything to post on my own pages. So, you know, it's just not a winning situation for me.
No, it's definitely one of my just little things. I just had to give him his own little space, and it is kind of cool to build a gallery of pictures of him at over time. It's been kind of fun, but he's a roly poly cat that's kind of my right hand every day. So yeah, he's a character, but I will definitely have I'll have to send you a special note when he wears the Viking battle hat, so you can at least get a look at it.
Please do. I am always excited to see cats in hats, and especially the disgruntled looks they usually have. They're great.
Yes. Well, let's start first with your – I'm going to have Michael talk to you about, you know, cover a few things with you next here because he actually has to head out at the 10 o'clock hour. And so I want to make sure he gets plenty of time to talk about whatever he'd like to with you. But just so the audience can kind of get a little bit into what you do as a writer, if you want to talk about your fantasy work, and you know, the type of fantasy you do, the new book that came out in November, if you could give us a little overview about your stuff.
All right. So I write fantasy novels and sometimes novellas about badass women who overcome trauma to do amazing things. Moonshadow's Garden is actually my second published book. My first published book was a novella called Keeper of the Dawn. It was a YA fantasy. Unfortunately, the small publisher I was with closed, so Keeper of the Dawn is unpublished right now, but I am hoping to re-release it early next year. It's kind of more of a romance-y story, so I'm hoping to release it in February and cash in on all those Valentine's Day dollars.
So how's the response been to everything so far? Because
been pretty good. I was very sick around the time that the book that Moonshadow's Guardian actually came out, and I wasn't really able to do as much of the marketing as I wanted to. So my release wasn't quite what I've wanted it to be, but I have picked up steam since then, and I'm working on a lot of other amazing things. You mentioned Review Pit, that's one big thing. I actually sent out about 10 arcs of my own for that, and I'm really excited to see the results. Things are slowly trickling in. And that was really
nice.
Cool because that was our first review pit. So to get 10 people on the first time we're running this event and to see that lots of other authors were getting reviewers too was really, really cool.
Now, I saw that and was looking into that, and I think that was a fabulous hashtag event that you did there. And so, yeah, definitely wanted – that's you've kind of given me a great segue there. But, yeah, talk about – yeah, you co-hosted that. And I guess in terms of, you know, how you came about with, you know, the concept and, you know, and then you've given a little picture on how well it went. But, yeah, give us a little overview of your hashtag Review Pit events.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about really hard this year is how indie authors can come together and do grassroots marketing to really make a grassroots indie movement, because a lot of visibility now is about pay-to-play advertising, and that's not fair to a lot of indie authors and a lot of authors who are struggling and low income. And so one thing that I really want to focus on is helping authors find free promo opportunities and build those opportunities together. And Review Pit came out of, I believe it was a Happy Writing Chat, which is another Twitter chat. It's hashtag Happy Writing Chat. It happens on Sunday afternoons at 1 p.m. EST. And someone was saying, you know, their biggest question was how to connect to book bloggers. And so the idea of having Review Pit was born. It's similar to PitMad, which is a publishing pitch contest. So people will pitch to agents and editors online. And so we based it, we modeled Review Pit after that. We reached out to a whole bunch of book bloggers in advance, and we had a whole bunch more people join up on the actual day of. And it was really cool to see all of the different writers pitching stuff and to see people connecting with them.
Now, that'd be fantastic. And right now, I recognize one of our people in the chat room, filmmaker Thomas Moore. And I'm like, I'm sure, yeah, you could even expand that concept into the indie filmmakers and all kinds of other things too. I mean, that's a great way to, you know, kind of bring artists and reviewers together. I mean, and looking through your hashtag thread, I mean, it was some good exchanges going on there. I mean, it was quite a bit of activity there.
Yeah, we were definitely nervous about how it was going to go, especially, you know, as a first-time event. We knew the authors would come. Of course, the authors will come. Everyone needs reviews.
Yes.
It's our lifeblood. But we weren't really sure about the reviewer turnout, and we were frankly blown away. I co-hosted it with Happy Writing Co., which is Dion and Mercedes I honestly don't know how to pronounce people's last names. I'm not even going to try.
Oh, it's okay. I have the same thing as me. Yeah.
I know how to pronounce one of their names. I'm going to just quit while I'm ahead, you know? You can find both of them on the Happy Writing Co. website.
Yeah, and it's a necessary thing because, I mean, even if, I mean, it's just driven me crazy over the last year or two because, I mean, even, you know, I've lost reviews myself in cases where, you know, the just the book blogger happened to, you know, have had friended me on Facebook among my, you know, nearly 4,600 close and personal friends there. I mean, it's just crazy how
they have a spending limit too now. You have to spend like $50 a year in order to have your review stay up. I had one review disappear right at the beginning of the year and then reappear like 3 weeks ago because I guess the person spent enough money on Amazon. Yeah, it's bizarre. Getting reviews on Amazon is an uphill battle.
Yeah. Well, Michael, you could speak to that a little bit because, well, I mean, you have had a lot of reviews, but, I mean, but you've had your frustrations with the review process for indie authors as well. So,
yeah, it just,
you want to dive
it
in and
like,
talk a little bit about this phase?
Yeah, I don't know if you've experienced this. It sounds like maybe you have, but it just seems like the, you know, about, 5-6 years ago when my first, you know, set of books were coming out, the reviews were a lot easier to come by, that there were a lot more of them and a lot of good quality reviews that were being done. And now it just seems like the number of people and sites doing reviews with Amazon and Goodreads, the quality of the reviews just doesn't seem to be there like it used to be.
I haven't noticed that as much. And it's a lot more noticeable on the Amazon side, I would say, now that they've put such strict rules in place, and it's because a lot of the people that genuinely want to review your work try, and their reviews don't go up for whatever reason that Amazon decides they're unworthy. And Goodreads doesn't have that problem. Your friends can post reviews for you, but I will say for sure I find getting reviews on actual blogger sites is harder than it used to be.
I agree,
to get it up on the actual blogs. And a lot of bloggers are just too busy now because they've been doing it for 5 or 6 years. And so they get so many requests, and so they'll throw you an interview or something, but they just don't have time to read your book even if they want to. I've had multiple reviewers say, I would love to read your book, but I'm already 4 months behind on my review list, and I can't commit right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and especially when you get in this situation where you're doing a series, and if the book that's coming out is part of a series, and they haven't read books one through whatever of the series, and you've got, you know, book 7 coming out, you know, it's you know, not going to be easy for a reviewer to pick up and review book 7 without having read the other books before it.
Yeah, unless it's like a Discworld style series.
Right.
But that's a problem in my future. So
right.
I'm not too worried about that right now.
But Daniel's on his book 1, and then I've got some series that have advanced, you know, at least the, you know, 3rd, 4th books, you know, and so forth. So, yeah, I've seen the problems that, you know, Michael's talking about. And Daniel, you're about to head into those waters, but, yeah, it's definitely, even a little tougher. Yeah.
But, and you mentioned earlier that you have the strong kick-ass female characters, which are a particular interest of mine. I always want to have like kick-ass women in my stuff. What sets your heroines above the normal fantasy heroines that are out there in the reading world?
Well, that's a very different question for each of the two characters. Because Keeper of the Dawn is YA, it's very different. And the main character in Keeper of the Dawn is actually very spiritual. She is extremely devoted to her gods, and so she's a sacred warrior. She sees fighting as a form of worship, which I think is a really unique way to look at it. And actually, in her culture, most fighting is ritualistic. It's they do displays before feasts and things like that. She has to do other kinds of fighting throughout her story, but that, to me, was something really important to her. Fighting is almost a form of meditation. And Rihanna, the main character of Moonshadow's Guardian, is unique because she is a cursed demigod. So she can take a lot of punishment. It's a lot of fun writing scenes with her because she heals fast. I can do a lot of things I can't get away with when I'm writing about a human woman.
Right.
Those are just the things that I find fun in their writing, though. I can't say for sure what you would appreciate most about them. You'll have to read and tell me yourself.
There you go. There you go.
Daniel, you have something you want to ask?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I just got off a blog tour recently. And one of the bloggers, that was one of the questions that they were asking me, you know, was different things about my book. And I was like, well, you'll just have to read the book if you want to find that out.
One thing that's really hard for me is knowing what I can say without spoiling things, especially because right now
right.
I'm working on the sequel to Moonshadow's Guardian, and so the lines are really blurry. The timelines are kind of blurred together in my head because I've been bouncing back and forth, rereading Moonshadow's Guardian for little details to make sure I get everything right. And it's hard to know what I can say without ruining the story while still giving you enough to make the story attractive.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's the trouble we all have with blurbs, too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. You want the really cool blurb, but you don't want it to give too much away.
Exactly. It's a real
right.
struggle.
Yeah, and I say the
like
book
the,
too.
Like
that's
the,
even harder because you're trying to get interest, but at the same time, you know, you're having to, you know, build off the book one plot, and you know how much do you give out you know for readers that haven't read book one yet versus the crowd that you're trying to get excited about book two that have read book one. So it's almost
well,
like
exactly.
a couple different groups.
You know, well, and I don't know about anybody else, but I struggle with that just with the, you know, back cover text. It's like, you know, what do you put on the
mm-hmm.
on the back cover that's going to entice people to read it without, you know, especially if it's, you know, book two, three, four in a series.
Right.
You know, after so-and-so died, they did, you know, you can't do that.
Exactly. I've actually had a series where I picked them up in the wrong order, and the first line of the blurb on the back of the book was, you know, after they killed this person or, like, conquered this kingdom or whatever. I forget the exact phrasing. And I looked at it, and I'm like, well, I guess I know they win in book one.
Right.
And
well,
that's not always
a bad thing,
but...
Well, I couldn't believe it. I was at the theater, and I was watching trailers, and they had a trailer for the Happy Death Day 2, and or whatever, and I have the original Happy Death Day. I picked it up on Blu-ray, but I hadn't watched it yet. And so I'm sitting there, and they basically give away the entire ending of the first movie in the trailer for the second one. I'm like, well, okay.
That's rough. And I mean, I get
well,
it. It's hard to not do that, but ow, that sucks.
Well, I could have thought of like three or four different ways they could have done it without directly giving away what happened at the end, but they chose to go that way. It's like, oh, you've all seen it. This is the second one.
No, we haven't all seen it, but we don't have to look at it now because you've already given
yeah.
it to us. So.
Well, and it's the same thing, especially like when people are, you know, coming up to you and talking about, you know, your books in a live setting, whether it be, you know, at a book signing or a convention or a library or whatever, and they're talking to you about your books, it's like, you know, I always like have to choose my words carefully when I'm talking about this series, because you don't want to, I mean, you want to give them enough to let them know whether or not it's something they'd be interested in, but you don't want to give away too many character traits or plot points or, you know, something that you've lived with for so many years since you wrote the first one or whatever. You know, you forget that that's a spoiler at a certain point.
That's so true, too. I forget these things all the time. I mean, and I've lived with these stories, some of them, for so long that one of my biggest comments from my early readers is often, I don't understand this, because it's also natural to me that I don't realize what I have to explain sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something my editor and I work on a lot is you know, I come from a very visual background. You know, I went to one of my college background and whatnot was very, you know, film and video oriented. And so I tend to write to paint a picture that, you know, so that you'll see what I'm seeing. But sometimes my editor's like going, you don't need that detail. You don't need all that, you know. And so we're cutting back and whatnot. But it's hard, especially when, you know, you've got something in your head and you're trying to get it out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a nightmare to walk that tightrope and figure out what you need and what you don't need. I don't know about you with your fight scenes and especially the ritualistic displays and whatnot, but you know, it's like I always joke about if I was writing a screenplay, I'd be done by now because I wouldn't have to go into such detail or, you know, get into everybody's heads and what they're thinking and whatnot. It's just like, you know, you describe he hits her
Not even just that. You can sub in, instead of doing so much world building, you can just sub in certain aesthetic details, and because people will see that and they have it in like their historical canon of Hollywood, they'll just buy it. There are so many things I see them in movies and shows that I'm like, I would not be able to get away with that in a book. That's not the way that people read fiction. But when they see it in a film or a TV show, they just believe it without further thought sometimes. It's especially bad if you watch anime at all. In anime, they have no concept of physics. There's just no such thing.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, it is funny because, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day about a scene I was writing, and I said, you know, this scene has a very anime like feel to it. You know, but anime is so visual, and it's interesting to walk that
line.
I mean,
there are some fantasy books I think should just be made into anime straight out because they wouldn't do for any other form of adaptation, because some scenes are like that in even well-known traditionally published books.
Right.
When I was reading the Mistborn books, for example, by Brandon Sanderson, I kept thinking, you know, the magic system that they use, Allomancy, would work so beautifully in the medium of animation, but I can't see them pulling it off in live action. Although that's less true now because they've really pushed things far with some of the adaptations they've done in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And with all the different technologies that they've got, they can do that type of stuff that they couldn't do, you know, 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's a big risk.
Well, I remember,
it's expensive, but they can do it.
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at, like, the, you know, the fantasy films that from the 80s that I grew up with, you know, the Excalibur and Conan the Barbarian and Sword and the Sorcerer and stuff like that. You know, the stuff that they had to do with practical effects, the magic and whatnot. Compare that to like a Harry Potter or Fantastic Beasts or even Charmed on the new Charmed on TV or the old Charmed even. You know, it's it's amazing the difference of what the effects can bring to, you know, the ability to do different magic systems.
I'm really out of the loop. There's a new Charmed.
Yeah. The only reason I know that is because my future daughter-in-law is a huge Charmed fan, and they announced that it's on the CW, of course, so they have to get, you know, beautiful-looking people, young people to do something.
CW knows what they're doing, though.
Well, they've also brought back Roswell, which I didn't know.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. The remakes are really, really something.
My mother, of all people, was telling me there's this show called Roswell, and there's these young people. I said, and they live in Roswell? Yeah, and they might be children of aliens. And yeah, how'd you know? Because I watched it in the 90s.
Wow, that's great. And they're also making a Lord of the Rings TV show, apparently.
Yep.
Which kind of terrifies me. I would be okay with a Middle Earth TV show, but frankly, I think Peter Jackson's movies should be allowed to stand on their own. They are beautiful works of art. You shouldn't try to supersede them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, the source material is going to be interesting on that, because I'm a huge Tolkien. I mean, that's one of my two biggest influences as a writer, and love the Peter Jackson movies. And when I saw that they were doing that, I was like, okay, they're probably going to dive into the Silmarillion for their source material. They said it's going to be set in the Second Age, so it's definitely going to be, when Sauron was young, so to speak.
I didn't look too much into it. I've had too much bad news lately. I was like, yeah. I'm afraid to click on this link.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, the good news, there is good news with this. It's not going to be, they're not going to be covering the stuff in the Peter Jackson movies. They're going far back from that. And so it's definitely going to be using some really the source material.
Are they going to use some of Christopher's stuff?
And Galadriel are still the same actors, though, somehow. I hope they can afford them.
Right. I don't know about that. But you're right. That's where it starts to, you know, kind of fracture a little bit, maybe. But the thing is that, yeah, with the books, you have such a, you know, rich, with the novels at least, you had such a rich amount of source material to build the films from. Now you have a lot of flexibility. Because the Silmarillion reads more or less like a history book, you know, they could, you know, that it could go really well or it could go really badly, and that's what I'm concerned about, you know, just because it's, they're going to have to generate so much more.
Yeah.
So when does Michael start writing for that series?
yeah. No, man. So what are you saying, Michael? About that with Lord of the Rings?
A lot of people were really complaining about the amount of Silmarillion material and whatnot that he incorporated into the Hobbit movies.
Right.
And they're like, oh, it's just a money grab. He's just padding it out. And it didn't need to be three movies. And, well, no, it didn't need to be three movies, but it was cool to see all that stuff added into the. To give you a sense of, you know, because when you read The Hobbit, you're always like, well, where the hell did Gandalf go? You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why did he just leave? And you know, it's cool that they're able to draw on that and you know, just connect the movies so they all, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I kind of look at it the same way I look at the prequels to Star Wars in that. Although I think Hobbit films are far, yeah, exactly right. but you know, it's like if you're approaching the movies from, you know, if someone is now young and just approaching the movies for the first time, if they start from The Hobbit, everything builds, you know, into Lord of the Rings, whereas. The way that we all saw it, you know, we saw the Lord of the Rings movies first, and then we go back and we're seeing The Hobbit, and we're like, oh, they just stuck that in to tie it into Lord of the Rings. They didn't need that, and so we're more nitpicky about it than someone who's just going to be watching it for the first time.
Well, I think for me, actually, the thing about The Hobbit being three films that bothered me was that Lord of the Rings was originally split into six parts. So I know, why does The Hobbit get 3 movies and Lord of the Rings only also get 3 movies?
Right.
Because that
well,
is a huge story.
Look,
there is a lot they left out.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the extended editions, though, of Lord of the Rings, it could have been 6 movies. Because, I mean, you sit down to watch one of those extended editions,
sure.
And it's, you know, it's 4 hours.
But they still didn't include the whole wreckage of the Shire when...
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, that's like 100 pages
what
of material.
What happened to the Shire?
And...
Yeah.
Rosebud's
in Galadriel's
and
mirror
of course
in the whole movie.
Yeah, and the big complaint from a lot, you know, they totally had to cut out the Tom Bombadil stuff as well.
Well,
me and my mom have had that argument 1,000 times. We are still on a standoff.
Any, you know, if you go to the BBC radio broadcast and whatnot, it's like everybody, the first thing to go is Tom Bombadil. Tom Bombadil always the first thing to go.
Yeah,
I think my mom just like her because she's a hippie.
Yeah, in the books, he's just a phenomenal character, but, you know, in the film sense, I mean, it's just not going to work with the flow of the narrative. I mean, it's just going to derail the pace big time, and I understand totally why he, you know, went around that. But, yeah, that was definitely, I mean, when the movies came out, I mean, that was definitely one of the biggest gripes from the book crowd, for sure. And well, you can't look at them as
possibly the most controversial. It seems everyone's on a different side of that one specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, when I was originally helping John write the first books and everything, it was, you know, we knew that we would have this issue with people later on.
Right. Oh, man.
You have to understand that Daniel's over 200 years old, so.
Yeah, Daniel's over 200 years old.
I was thinking you're really dating yourself there, buddy.
Yeah. He personally experienced the Victorian era, which is cool, but, you know, yeah, he's our elder. But...
I told him about the things that happened before, you know, there was a telephone.
Right. Oh, man. Yeah, speaking of which, Daniel, I do have a comment from the chat room directed toward you. It was when you were talking about giving detail, when Michael was talking about giving detail. They said, Thomas said, I can't write books, but I don't give enough detail. He said, ask Daniel. So... So I just thought I'd pass that along. That's from the chat room.
Thomas, I'm not throwing you under the bus, but you are a great screenplay writer.
Hey, that's a valuable skill.
It is a valuable skill. I don't know if I can write a screenplay. Never done one before.
And,
Thomas does it well.
And I've had this discussion with people before. You know, I used to have conversations with Tom Tolles.
Yourself?
Tom Tolles, who was in Night of the Living Dead remake and Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer and Devil's Rejects, and we would talk about how he had done lots of screenplays, but he was unsure of writing prose. And, you know, I had done some screenplays and teleplays back in college and high school and whatnot, but my main focus has always been the fiction writing. And so we go back and forth about different things, and it is really two different mindsets. You know, it's the amount of detail, unless you're James Cameron and you're handing over, you know, 500 pages to Robert Rodriguez
and $500 million.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a very, very different skill set as far as writing and formatting for a screenplay as opposed to writing for a short story or a novel.
For sure. I was co-writing a graphic novel for a bit, and I've tried screenplays before, and I found that the graphic novel format was a really happy medium for me. But screenplays are I feel the need to be too directorial in screenplays, and I know that, you know, the director also is supposed to have a place when you're making a movie. That's sort of how it works. It's a different team dynamic. It's a real team, not just, you know, I send you things to have them double-checked, which is sort of what mm-hmm. we do when we send our stuff to editors. We're sending it to have them look at it, but they don't actually get any final say over what happens.
Yeah, it's definitely right. the early stage of the process. You know, it's the blueprint of the project, and as it moves forward, I mean, like I said, in all the projects I've been involved with film wise, I mean, it's, you know, you end up getting, you know, the director for sure, but also, you know, various actors will bring things to the table, and, you know, and that will affect, you know, things that, you know, make changes in the way the screenplay was originally written. Sometimes you'll have it based on locations you have to use as an independent filmmaker. You know, lots of things will occur in the process that actually will change what was originally in the screenplay. And, yeah, by talking about the team dynamic is a perfect way of describing it. Because it is,
and,
yeah, as opposed to book writing, it's definitely a team approach. But yeah, it's an art in itself, though, as a writing, you know, in terms of the writing spheres, it takes a lot to be a good screenplay writer.
Well, and I recommend to anyone who's a writer who's interested in writing, or you know, just a fan of cinema, go back and read, like, the screenplays for Rear Window and, mm-hmm. You know, some classic films, Casablanca. Read those original screenplays and see how much of it actually translated to the screen and, you know, what the writers envisioned as opposed to what the final product was. And it's a really good education.
Yeah, and on that note, I'll ask Thomas real quick, because he'll have a recommendation, I'm sure, for us. But there are some sites online, and it just escapes me, and I'm hoping Thomas can remind me quickly. But they have archives of screenplays, so it's easy to download whatever movie you want and read them. It's not something that's going to be hard for anybody listening tonight to get, as far as the, you know, original screenplays. They're very much made available online, and I just can't remember some of the key sites. But
there are also some shows that have sample scripts, I'm pretty sure, so that writers who want to send them work can use that as a basis for them. I don't remember the sources for that either, but, like, the scripts are out there if you want to read them.
Oh, yeah. They are.
And sometimes it's hilarious. Sometimes it's hilarious the details that get put into a screenplay that are never meant. I mean, they're meant for the actors. They're meant for the director to read, mm-hmm. and kind of get a sense of these characters, but they're never meant for the audience. And some of the things that get written in these screenplays are really humorous, as opposed to, you know, what actually showed up on the screen. You know, just little remarks that they make about different characters and different actions and whatnot. And you're like, yeah, no, that's who that person is. But it's never talked about on screen, it's in the screenplay. So those are always fun.
Well, Diana, have you ever cast your, Moonshadow's Guardian? Have you ever thought of it in a film sense? And if so, have you ever cast any of the characters into, you know, who's in that?
The only kind of film I've ever thought of it as is animated, frankly. I'm not the type of person who really does casting, and I think it's because of how strong the images of my characters already are in my head. I mm-hmm. cannot project those images onto real people. I've never found anyone that looks right. maybe someday that'll change, but for now, the character images I have in my head are so strong and so overpowering that I can't really see them being cast as anyone that I know of. Of course, I hardly know anything about actors. I've got my head buried very far under the sand as far as that goes, so maybe I'm missing out on someone.
Well, have you ever thought about voice characters?
Not really. It's more that I think about animation styles, if anything, and I would definitely want something that is not necessarily anime, but is very much anime influenced. Like, have you heard of Avatar: The Last Airbender?
Oh yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, like that cartoon
yes, watch,
is actually
watch the watch the cartoon, the anime. Do not watch the film.
Yeah.
It was literally just.
Hello.
Hello. I think did we lose Diana? Oh, hopefully not.
Diana,
Michael, you there? Okay. I think she dropped. I think her audio just dropped.
No. Right in the middle of her
get in real. While we wait,
she's done messing with us.
Yeah. Well.
Hello.
Avatar: The Last Airbender.
There she is.
Hi. Woo. You can hear me.
There
now?
She is.
Yes.
Yeah. I can hear you. Yeah.
All right, but yeah, there is no Avatar: The Last Airbender movie. There is a parody that's kind of like it, but there's no actual movie. There is only the show, and
it's
Canadian,
so
which is a point of pride because I'm Canadian. But it's very much inspired by anime. The style is very much like anime, and sometimes I even forget that it isn't Japanese.
Right.
So what
yeah,
was the movie Avatar: The Last Airbender?
Oh, gosh. It was done by M. Night Shyamalan.
I saw it, but I, you know.
Oh.
Is that the same storyline?
I have no idea. I never saw it because I heard it was that bad.
It was. Yep. And Diana, you'll appreciate this. Literally, one of the characters starts to give the backstory for a character by talking to his troops and saying, as you all know.
Great. I love it.
Oh, that's
my favorite.
And then goes in and gives a complete backstory. And then 2 minutes later, we see it in flashback.
Really?
After they've already told us about it.
What a waste of resources, too. Like, you're doing this whole flashback scene anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just
oh
it's
man,
just really
that's good.
It's one of those movies that should be. It's one of those movies as a writer you should study on what not to do.
I think there are a lot of movies like that. To be fair, there are definitely some books like that too.
Oh yes.
Well, Thomas did chime in from the chat room, by the way, and being the indie film encyclopedia that he is, yes, he had several sources for those screenplays, and I will just read them real quickly. IndieFilmHustle.com has them. SFY.RU has them. ScreenplayDB, and that's D as in dog, B as in boy. ScreenplayDB.com has them. And SimplyScripts.com also has them. And he says ScriptReader Pro is another one. So yeah, those are some that Thomas has given us in the chat room, and
that's a great list. Thank you, Thomas.
So yes, he,
awesome,
so if you want to
yeah,
do what Michael was saying earlier and read classic screenplays of movies you like, those are some places to do some searches there. So SFY was script for you. That's what it stood for. So
I don't know, Diane, if you've had this experience too, but the one thing about watching a film or a screenplay as a writer of fiction that really helps is with pacing.
Yeah.
It really, really helps you to understand how you should pace certain things.
Yeah, and it's really important, I think, to look at that as well, because a lot of the sort of seminal books that we study tend to have a much slower pace because that was the style of writing. But now people are so used to watching film and TV shows that they're used to much faster-paced stories. And so, yeah, there's still an audience for a slow-burn book, but it's not what it used to be. A lot of people are looking for a faster-paced adventure.
That's true. Very true. And, I've noticed that too. Yeah, a lot of people when we've been talking about Tolkien, especially, like people read him for the first time, you know, today. And you get a lot of that even from folks too. I hear that quite a bit. But But yes, things always, but you know what happened, you know, things always go in cycles, so you never know. The slow burn books, you know, maybe the thing in the future here, so you just never know.
That's true. I do think vampires are about to come back into vogue, and I'm just going to throw it out there that there are a bunch of sexy vampires in Moonshadow's Guardian. Both binary genders, so you can take your pick.
Well, that got Daniel excited there.
I'm just hoping that they're coming back in vogue, but I have seen some of their some vampire stories starting to pop back up again, and they seem a little bit less tacky than the ones that came in the Twilight wave. I think Twilight really did a disservice to vampires.
I'm sorry, I have an allergic reaction every time I hear the word Twilight. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, that's about, it's interesting you mentioned that, Diana, because that's about to get
down.
You are about to get a serious boost in the vampire world from Anne and Christopher Rice, because their new Lestat series starts this fall in September, I believe. They start shooting it this fall. Yeah. Goes into full production.
Shooting it?
Yeah.
You mean it's going to be a TV show?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, what?
Yeah,
how did I not? Wow, I've really been hiding under a rock these last couple
months. And the
months.
Reason that
I
absolutely know about that is because we were hoping to get Christopher Rice for Imaginarium, and unfortunately had to decline because they're in production when we're doing our convention. So that's what we did. We got that straight from him.
Yes.
That's amazing. That's, but yeah, they're going to be doing that this fall in production. So I assume that, you know, that 2020 it'll be aired. I don't know. Holly's on pins and needles about the casting for Lestat, but yeah, because that's her favorite character of all time. So have to see who's her pick here.
You know, I don't. You know, I'm about to get some hate mail here. I'm probably, but I don't think. You know, everybody gave Tom Cruise a fair shake because if you look at the movie that was done, and you look and you look at it in terms of the source material, the Lestat is one way, an interview with a vampire, because it's told from a certain point of view, and he's totally different when it's just about him. And if you look at the bulk of that movie and compare it to the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise is totally different at the end of the movie as Lestat than he is throughout the whole movie when it's from Lewis's point of view. And I thought that they captured that brilliantly, and just that he was much more cavalier, much more fun-loving, much more,
but the other Lestat was way more attractive. Did you see that?
Stuart
Townsend. From Queen of the Damned. Yeah, that was...
Yeah, Stuart Townsend,
that was a better
name.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise is too much traditional action hero. He never, as much as his acting chops may be good, I couldn't buy his physicality as Lestat. And for a character like Lestat, that's a huge thing. There are some characters where I'm very happy to overlook that kind of thing, but for a character like Lestat, who's so much of... his personality and his story is rooted in his physicality and his sexuality. I just expect better than Tom Cruise. I mean, to be frank, I expected someone better looking than Robert Pattinson to play Edward Cullen too, but I, you know, sometimes they just go with who they go with.
Well, you know, and the trouble is you when you have to work with humans, it's hard to find. Well, you know, Anne Rice was a huge fan of Blade Runner, and after she saw Blade Runner, she thought that Rutger Hauer was the perfect Lestat. And for years, she tried to make an interview with a vampire with Rutger Hauer as Lestat.
Did he just refuse? I would see that movie. That would be great.
Right? I would see Rutger Hauer in anything. I've seen Hobo with a Shotgun, okay?
From Lady Hawk to Hobo with a Shotgun, how his career changed.
Love it. Blade Runner, too. Mal, he's amazing.
Oh, yeah, and it's amazing because, you know, I have to remind myself sometimes that he was all of those people, because they're such different roles, and that's something not a lot of actors can do. So many actors get typecast, but he's been so many different things, from Lady Hawk to Hobo with a Shotgun, and I honestly admire that.
Oh, Lady Hawk. Oh, that's another movie that I think that people forget about, but I absolutely love Lady Hawk.
That movie
pretty
much was my childhood, so.
Phenomenal movie.
I hate to cut out.
In terms of typecast actors, Thomas Moore just was bringing up some of the other great vampire performers, and we both agreed about Gary Oldman. You know, he doesn't get enough credit from his Dracula performance sometimes, I think. And he's one that doesn't get typecast, because he's also like Rutger Hauer. He's in so many diverse
of
roles.
Look at Gary Oldman. Gary Oldman has been Sid Vicious. He's been Dracula. He's been, he's been everything. For me, the Dracula actors are, you know, Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee, and Gary Oldman. I mean, that's Dracula to me.
Dracula, yeah.
Yeah. But, I hate to take my leave. It's been wonderful, Diane, but I must go. I have much to do for this weekend and whatnot. And,
I'm frankly exhausted, and I don't think I want to stick around for too much longer myself, so any final questions? Sorry, it's been a long day, and I'm not used to doing calls and socializing this late anymore. I'm like an old lady
now.
You've been
wonderful.
We can wrap her up. Yeah, definitely, no problem. And but the only other thing I was going to ask about was you know, if you wanted to talk about your other event you host on Twitter, Weeknight Writers, some of our listeners might be interested in that.
Yeah, so that is every Thursday night at 7 p.m. EST. Like I said, this is pretty late for me. I actually made Weeknight Writers at 7 p.m. because I found that a lot of chats were at 9 p.m. and it's usually just not a time when I can be social. In any capacity. It's usually when I want to, like, log off my computer and go to bed because I've been on it all day. So it's Thursday night, 7 p.m. EST. We do a different topic every week, and I have a set of questions that I ask, and all you need to do to participate is answer the questions and include the hashtag WeeknightWriters in your response.
Awesome.
Something else I would like to plug before I go, and that is another Twitter event that I am just in the middle of developing. It is, again, with the goal of getting indie authors to work together and to really build our own grassroots promotion movement. And what I'm working on is called Indie eBooks Day. The idea is that people take pictures of themselves reading indie books on their e-readers, because ebooks are a lot more accessible both for disabled readers and for indie authors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's to really celebrate the hard work that indie authors are doing and to also celebrate the medium of ebooks. And I have created a Twitter account for that you can follow at Indie eBooks Day. And I'm going to be launching a whole bunch of information there tomorrow. I was actually working on it right up until I started this call, pretty much, and might do a little bit more work on it before I go to bed. So there's going to be lots of stuff coming out there over the next few days, and it's definitely an account to watch for any authors who are interested in promo opportunities or for any readers who want to connect with more indie authors.
Yeah, share. Yeah,
cool.
Definitely let us know the links and connections again for that, because we will post that for you and definitely in our channels. And
awesome.
Before you sign out, though, I do want to give you a chance to tell readers and everybody else where to find you online. Where do you prefer people connect with you on social media or websites?
So I actually just built a new author website and launched it last week. So you can find me at www.authordianagun.com. Diana with two N's and Gun with two N's. That's the key. The important thing to remember is that both of my names have two N's in them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining with us tonight. I know, we do have a later evening podcast, but it's been totally enjoyable having a great conversation with you. That first hour blew by very quick. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I hope I can gather the spoons to come on sometime again. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and definitely, Holly will definitely be listening to this episode for sure. And take care. And, next every Wednesday right here at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Star Chamber Show. So on behalf of everyone, good night, everybody, and take care.
Good night.
Good night.